Reminiscenza. I wandered off in a prairie blizzard 85 years ago. The cold rendered me spellbound, then to now. I have outlived the decree and find myself afraid to die. I cannot will cloudbursts the way I once did. I must recollect with yet greater fury. It was a fever then. It remains a fever now. I will not die as long as I live this story. I run to then to buy myself moments now. 23 days. Blood libel. A policeman knocks on a young woman's door. Murderer's flags, a swirl. 23 days. This storm. Reminiscenza. This is the opening of Perfidia, a sprawling new noir opera by James Ellroy, the first book in his second L.A. quartet, set in the many contiguous underworlds of Los Angeles, 1941, in the incendiary days following the bombing of Pearl Harbor. It's crime fiction on an epic scale, veering from the romantic to the psychotic and back again, at the speed of death. Put on your riot gear and light up a lucky. Join us for the Perfidia edition of Book Circle Online.
From the Library of Maria Menounos, this is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
Hello, and welcome back to Book Circle Online. This is Jason Squamata. I am here with my ravishing co-hosts,
Pat Janowski
and
Mark Savage.
And we are here today to discuss the latest book by the great James Ellroy, the self-proclaimed demon dog of American crime fiction. His new book is called Perfidia. And what thoughts have we? Right off the top, about Perfidia.
Wow, I'm just blown away. I feel like I'm wading in inches of blood. Mm. I just want to wash all my clothes, but you can't wash this stuff out. It's just he really gets in there.
Yeah,
really gets in there. It's full of double crossing. It's full of faith as well. It's full of hope that's destroyed.
Romanticism,
yeah,
like mysticism,
absolutely,
yeah,
that kind of, whether it's Catholic mysticism, whether it's kind of the Hollywood,
right, the kind of pagan mysticism of Hollywood, I
absolutely
feel like it
keeps
going there,
absolutely,
and it is filled with blood, double crossing, horrible things, but it's leavened by all this. Well, not, I shouldn't even say leavened, because there's nothing light about this book, except the romanticism, and not in just the like relationship man woman sense,
right.
But there's a, such a sweetness
to the
end of this book in particular.
Right.
You know, it's almost Shakespearean, how everybody gets coupled up.
Yeah.
But kind of.
Right.
Poor Hideo.
And we should say that I think if you go into a James Ellroy book expecting the bad people to be punished and the good people to come through, that's not what ever happens.
Who's a good person
a good
and a bad person?
Well, that doesn't,
nobody's,
that, doesn't that
right,
raise
right,
the question?
Right.
These people are
person?
All very human. There's nothing black and white, good, bad.
And
about
human
them.
as a positive and a negative there.
Yeah. Oh.
You can't separate those things.
Right. That's what human means.
Right. Yeah. Well, and so, I mean, this quartet of characters through whom, you know, this vast story is told, we have Captain Whiskey Bill Parker, mm-hmm. who is a real person.
Yep.
And would eventually become the chief of the LAPD.
Right.
And a great firebrand and reformer. And we're seeing him at a kind of transitional state in his life.
Yeah.
And
trying to get off the sauce.
Trying to get off the sauce, sometimes trying harder than mm-hmm. others, mm-hmm. you know, but he has this great reformer zeal and
right.
thinks of himself as a very moral man.
Right.
Combined with
uh-huh.
an opportunist streak.
Yes, he's a politician.
Everybody, right from the beginning anyway, the other cops seem to have his number.
Yeah.
They seem to see that while he is very moral, which can be a problem for them
right.
in their line of work,
right.
He is also...
In this particular... LA.
In
yes.
this particular LA, yeah.
Particularly.
He is also...
In particular.
He is also very much out for himself. He's even got this plan whereby he he sees his future as the right. chief, as the guy who comes in and cleans this mess yeah. up. So he's quite happy for the mess to be getting messier.
Right. And he's actually an under Captain Jack Davis, uh-huh. who is, like, you know, notoriously corrupt. And, you know, we learn that he's corrupt beyond our wildest imaginings. But, you know, like, yeah, he kind
of... Whiskey Bill was there with him.
Yes, yeah. as his right-hand man mm-hmm. and breaking the legs and doing all the terrible
things. That he seems to... not feel happy about doing, right. but he's done nonetheless.
Yeah, but using that logic, like mm-hmm. you said, where he's setting the stage, like he will collude with this corruption so that there'll be more to clean up.
And he's setting himself up
yeah.
for a future
right.
you know, political advantage.
And everyone seems to know that about him. Everyone introduces him as the chief.
Yeah, and tries to do everything they can to stop it.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, that is going to be the guy.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's right, going right. to be the guy. It's going to be the, you can't believe that the real life thing happened
right.
from this book, but you can. That's the thing. It's beautifully set up that way.
Right, right, right.
So there is a quartet of characters.
Well, yeah, and in terms of like the good and evil of them, you know, just so he's someone who thinks of himself as a very moral character, mm-hmm. but is a politician, even more so than being a detective. Mm-hmm. And I think that keeps coming up.
Yeah.
That, and
whereas Dudley Smith is detective all the way.
Yes.
I mean, he is obsessed and
yeah.
and like a bulldog, he will not let go of stuff.
Like a wolf.
Yeah. Well, and his corruption. I mean, he's the embodiment of this.
And he is in a way, because the levels of his corruption go so deep. The angles that he's playing are so complex that it's hard at first to, like, you know, immediately Dudley Smith is no good.
Yeah.
He's a bad guy.
Right. But
he's
you
a bad
like
cop.
Him.
But you like him. The inevitable thing that happens when you read a book which goes into someone's head in the way this does, in four people's heads, is right. that you like them.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that happens in a novel.
Well, he
You're
does many, many good things.
Well, I think part of the contrast, you know, the many ways that he's kind of antithetical to Whiskey Bill is that, like, Bill is Parker is constantly failing himself,
mm-hmm.
and because he has this idea of moral rectitude in his head,
he's full of self-loathing. Yeah. He's the most pathetic character.
Yeah,
at certain
he is.
Points.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, and sometimes in a sympathetic way, but sometimes we're you know, kind of with everyone ugly. Else. And just
he's
kind of
the
like,
one who's always seen sitting in his car with the DTs or the
uh-huh,
shakes.
Yeah,
this happens to him five or six times during
right,
the book, where
right.
you see this happen. It's just like, oh, poor guy.
The poor guy.
Yeah.
The poor little wretch.
But Dudley seems to be one step ahead.
Well, Dudley. You know, is coming from a place, you know, like as a teenager, he was in Ireland and murdering British soldiers.
He was brought up this way, and he's at home in this atmosphere, and he's like king of the hill. Although he's always on the edge of being caught or something terrible happening to him. Or,
right. Well,
I see him as this guy that he understands human nature. Initially, it seems like more than any of the other characters.
Right.
In that. He has been to those terrible places,
uh-huh.
and he has done those terrible things.
Yeah.
And there's one point he says that he knows he can't go back to Ireland.
Right.
He can't go home.
Right.
And it's like, even though he wells up when he sees a woman in a green dress,
uh-huh.
he wells up. He's so romantic. He
right.
loves Ireland
Patriotic.
And he loves America, but he knows
right.
he can't go back. It's like he knows there's a line that's been drawn that he has crossed.
Right.
And I see that as a moral thing as well. He understands where he is.
Right,
he's got to live by the sword.
Well, it's like it seems like he, you know, there is some kind of code there where he knows how to behave ethically with people, and he can recognize the potential in people. Mm-hmm. And when Dudley Smith likes you,
Everybody is affected by that.
I mean, that's Hideo's lifesaver. Speaking
yeah.
of our four characters, that's
right.
the third one, Hideo Ashida.
Yeah, and who's relatively innocent, you know, but it's kind of the story.
He's the
of
one
him
you worry about,
realist.
I think,
yeah.
at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's really, really smart. Well, this is what we had James Ellroy come speak at in Art Fair City mere days ago. And I had the good
in
fortune
Portland?
Of...
In
Portland?
Yes, here in Portland. James Ellroy was here in Portland?
Yes. And I had the great pleasure and what's that word when you're...
Were you humbled, Pat?
I was humbled in front of the great man. I'd met him before. I like him. He's high lair and super smart. And
right. And to call him the great man, I mean, it seems like that's appropriate.
It's appropriate, yeah. but you wouldn't want to call him that to his face
right.
because he would believe you.
I'm too.
He's wry. He's really funny. Anyway, he was talking about Why was I bringing this up? Hideo Ashida.
You were talking about how clever Hideo was.
Oh, how clever he was. That was one thing he said about this, that all these characters, these four characters in this book, were each, in their own way, brilliantly smart, super smart, and that all of them were searching for meaning in things.
Yeah.
So these aren't, Dudley Smith is not a thug.
Right.
Whiskey Bill is not a mindless, uptight reformer.
Right.
Hideo Ashida is not a techno geek.
Right.
Kay Lake, who's our fourth,
she's not just a
dilettante who wants fame.
Right.
They all are deeply care about some sort of meaning.
Yeah.
And so that's what saves Hideo too. He is this lab geek. He's this super, he's Dexter or whoever, which not without the Dexter.
Without the connotations. Yeah, the serial killing has left to the other characters.
Yeah, exactly. So he's this technical Wunderkind, if we can mix German into this mix, boy, do the Germans come in.
It's still Axis.
Axis, sorry. Yeah. But he's, from the very beginning, we're in his head. And so we see that he's got this device, which plays some small part in the whole deal. But he's thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And he's really, you understand him.
Right. Well, he's obsessed. I mean, I think like all these characters, I mean, you know, they're searching for meaning, but not like in a, you know, sort of philosophical way. Sometimes like the meaning that they seek philosophically is in conflict with what actually drives them. They're all obsessed.
Mm-hmm. Almost every time.
Yeah. Yeah. And with Hideo, he's obsessed with Bucky Bleachert, who is the main character in the Black Dahlia.
Yep. Yeah.
And who we get little glimpses of in this story. And that's, I mean...
So does Hideo.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Hot naked glimpses.
it's so cute that they went to high school together.
No, it is.
Aw.
Yeah. And, but there's something about Hideo that makes his leering and his voyeurism like not creepy. He really does seem to be the most innocent character.
It's a love story for
mix.
Him. It's brilliant.
Especially sexually.
Right.
But also... His obsession initially, at least, seems to be trying to solve the case and also trying to save his family.
Because a lot of his innocence comes from the fact that he's like the kind of, you know, massive affliction or this great struggle that's being put upon the Japanese people because of in the wake of Pearl Harbor.
He's our symbol of that.
He's our symbol and the only victim of it in the story, whereas everyone else is either, you know, they're opportunistically trying to figure out how to exploit this situation. Mm-hmm. So almost all of our major characters know that this is wrong, the idea of putting, you know...
Rounding up Japanese-Americans.
But right, boy, can they profit from it if they do it right.
Yeah.
Even Dudley, I mean, it's...
That's where ideology is secondary to opportunism.
Yeah.
Right.
Even when you get right down to it.
Right.
The communist fear, even then, everybody... It's very rare that you see anybody who actually has... A genuine passion politically, and if you do, it's someone you see for a few seconds. It's Paul Robeson.
You know? Right. Sure.
It's Paul Robeson, but we don't
spend enough time with him to know what his actual deal is.
No, but we do. I mean, that completely segues into Kay Lake.
Right.
Yes.
Because she is given this assignment by Whiskey Bill to infiltrate this cell. And
the cell of Reds that we later see in The Big Nowhere.
Yeah, yes. And sabotage this thing, this movie they're making. Right. And she becomes the biggest believer in this movie, even so more so than Claire DeHaven.
Right.
And... So she's our fourth character, main character.
Yes.
And what do you think? Does her opportunism cloud her ideology to the extent that the rest of these do?
Well, I feel like she's a slightly different case because she's not a dilettante. She's not this flighty woman that a lot of people assess her that way. But she wants to live in a movie. People keep describing her. I think Claire DeHaven you know, who's sort of the victim of her surveillance and her seduction to some extent, but describes her as being a creature of supreme artistry and but no character or conviction.
Oh, and that kills her. That hurts. Right. Calyx so much, but she's aware of that.
I don't think that she's really told anything by anyone else that she doesn't know about herself. Yeah. She's full of self-doubt. She's someone who, I think, she's desperate for the cause, whatever the cause might be. And so she's searching for the thing that is her thing.
Yeah.
The other characters, who were all older than her in various ways, have either given up on that kind of thinking or are behaving in more selfish ways. I don't know that, although like Hideo's cause is clear to him because of the situation.
Right.
Being a Japanese man, he knows what his cause is.
He wants to solve this murder.
And he wants to survive.
Right.
And that becomes clouded as well because.
Right.
I can't survive this alone, so whose patronage do
Who
I accept?
Who am I going to throw in with? Any flip flops over and over again.
Yeah.
And you were saying earlier, Mark, that his descent into dissolution or horrible acts, killing Japanese down in Mexico, is kind of one of the most heartbreaking because he is one of our kind of purest characters at the beginning.
And because we know Dudley Smith and Whiskey Bill are already embedded in all of this terrible stuff.
Right.
And Calyx, we've seen before. And also at the beginning, she gives a nice reminder of the things that we know from the Black Dahlia.
Uh-huh.
We've seen her before, meaning we're going to see her in the future.
Right. Yes.
Perfidia is the first novel in James Ellroy's second L.A. Quartet, which precedes his first L.A. Quartet temporally.
And whose ultimate objective is to tie together his initial L.A. Quartet his Underworld USA trilogy form a massive, shrieking, psychotic tapestry of the secret underbelly
of
American history.
It's the 20th century.
Which is so cool. It's ambitious. It's fantastic. He has this list of, we'll talk about this in a minute, but dramatis personae in the end where he links everybody up and this person is real life and this person, appears in the Black Dahlia.
And that list is just going to get longer as it goes. And that's
he must have this complicated list, series of cards on his wall.
Oh, his graphs like Dudley Smith does where,
I bet that's what he does.
Yeah. Oh.
Right. Yeah, that bit felt like he was talking about at this
something
point,
real.
And this is a point maybe two-thirds of the way into the novel where Dudley Smith has got this graph in his cubicle that is filled with tiny writing. It's filled with abbreviations
shorthand,
and code
for himself.
It's Ellroy pacing out his novel. It really is. At this point, it's where am I?
Well, and I've heard him say, his previous book, Blood's a Rover, I think its ultimate, the finished work, its page count was 700 pages, and the outline was 500 pages.
So,
it's him.
He plans it.
Well, that's one thing that's interesting about the writing style in this book is how terse and concise the sentences. I mean, there's barely a comma in this book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just dun dun dun
right,
dun
right,
dun,
right.
And a lot of that is
bullet points.
Is bullet points. It almost you can see how his outline and his novels are going to be similar lengths.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm sure you've heard this bit of of his history. But L.A. Confidential was his editor told him it was 200 pages too long, the original draft. And but it's so convoluted and so densely interwoven, he couldn't take any actual scenes out. So he went through the book and took out every word that was unnecessary.
Oh, my gosh. That's a great story.
Arrived at his mature style. And you can see it, and you can see that progress. And then, the next book, White Jazz, which is from the point of view of Dave Klein, an insane, out-of-control, corrupt cop in the Ellroy mold, it's refined to the point of psychosis where he's entering a room and he's only seeing the relevant details.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that American Psycho effect of Bret Easton Ellis's book, but without the irony, without the attempt to be cheeky, where you have pages of brand names. His brain is a police blotter and he's just, and you get this
like the graph, like Dudley's graph.
Yeah. And I think, having kind of taken that maybe to its furthest point. I'm not sure if you read The Cold 6000, which was the second book of his Underworld USA. I think even he admits it was taken to a kind of alienating extreme, that particular style in that book. But I think he's come full circle to make something beautifully organic, where when he does get super staccato with most of the prose in this, it's like poetry. I mean, it is. It really is.
It's filled with there's a brilliant style that he gets to where it's full of repetition, but each character has different parts of what's going on, and they find at a certain point they probably all find out almost everything,
right?
And repeat certain things,
yeah.
And because of the convoluted plot, you need that, but it never feels like a recap.
Yeah,
it never
the guy
feels
buried
like that.
In a lime pit. Right. It's like, who's this guy exactly?
Yeah,
and then the three other people tell it from their point
you
of
get
view.
It. Yeah.
He's
get
disappeared.
It.
We think he might be in a lime pit.
Well, and even the same character, because all of these characters are obsessed.
Yeah. Trace it again. Go
yes,
back. Go
they're
back.
Going
walk
back
the
to
room
these
again.
Rooms. Yes,
and
it's a tremendous style that I wouldn't I wouldn't take to if it wasn't so good.
Right.
Because it's this great wash of information. You're drowning in all of this detail. And I asked him during the question and answer period, I was telling you this earlier, is he with all the names he introduces characters willy-nilly, left, right, there's hundreds and thousands of them. And they're all there for a reason. Mm-hmm. One of the ones that he's mentioned, it's going to come back. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the guy, but you don't quite know it, and you don't know which ones it's going to be. And I said, you know, when you bring all that up, there's a list of dramatis personae at the end. Mm-hmm. And I said, for me, that came way too late. I was completely lost. I was in this character soup that it did eventually congeal mm-hmm. into something that I could kind of swim through more easily or walk on even, and everything started to come kind of out of its own accord. And
what kind of in being swept away by the language and kind of letting go of the need,
just
to
letting it
identify.
Go. I don't need to know, uh-huh. and because you're going to hear it 8,000 more times.
Sure,
this one guy. Okay, so that's the guy.
Yeah. And you're being led to a great emotional.
And it's
scene.
He totally grabs you with that.
Right.
He makes that happen.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
you're not in control of your experience with this book.
Right,
he is.
Right. No, totally.
But similarly, as you're. I mean, I found myself doing something similar where I'm letting go of clinging to every detail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because you can't
it's impossible.
Cling to every detail.
This is a 700-page book.
This is book is filled with people who can't cling to every detail.
Yeah.
And you let the details go. But at the same time, I felt like my moral expectations of the characters, I was letting that go as well.
Yeah.
To the point where it gets to Hideo beating up some Japanese men that they found on a submarine.
Right.
It feels inevitable at that point.
Yeah.
I might have, if I'd known that was coming at the beginning, I would have been heartbroken.
Right.
But it seems inevitable.
Yeah. Well,
this is the only way this thing can happen.
Well, if memory serves, he opens with an epigram.
Yeah. I walked out. In 84 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
sorry,
his opening passage. But he opens with this epigram from the Bible, Proverbs 3:31. Envy thou not the oppressor and choose none of his ways. Yeah. No one in this book follows that advice.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Everyone is very aware of oppression. Everyone fetishizes the oppressor.
Even Kay Lake, she oppresses Hideo by forcing him to act her lover in this film they're making.
Yeah, no, true.
And she's, you know, you don't see her as an oppressor. You see
right.
her as sort of a victim.
Well, and I think Hideo in that moment is kind of, he's been the victim, or he's been the kind of, you know, token person who's allowed to exist in this cop world. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when he crosses that line, that moral line, it's just he's deciding to throw
in Mexico.
Know, ultimately. Yeah.
And he has to. But what's interesting to me is how a simpler book would be able to see the characters making decisions that were, oh, I'm doing this for money.
Right.
I'm doing this for power.
Right.
I'm doing this for sex.
Right.
I'm doing this for survival.
Yeah.
Everything gets so blurred in this book. And that's the Elroy world where...
And the humanity of it.
Oh,
yeah.
Completely.
Yeah.
Whereby at his worst, Dudley Smith becomes his most sympathetic.
Yeah.
It's really interesting how he manages to
Oh my gosh, when he shoots the guy in the phone booth, you don't I wasn't horrified, frankly. I wasn't. Not right. like Betty Davis's later, not like Kay Lake was.
And that was a real transgression.
But that...
It was a romantic gesture for him.
It was a romantic gesture for him. I laughed for maybe 20 minutes.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
I laughed aloud.
You can believe he did. Oh, my God.
Well, because he... To see him, first of all, to see him, because he's appeared, you know, in these other books as this kind of figure, this devil figure, this Mephistophelian figure leading, you know, young cops into different forms of degradation, and which is his natural element. But to see him with a crush on Betty Davis, mm-hmm. pursuing Betty Davis, swooning and going down on Betty Davis, and the tears in his eyes mm-hmm. when she returns his affection, mm-hmm. And for him, for this act of police brutality to be like a gesture of bouquet.
Here's a rose that I'm giving you.
Yeah, he blows this poor anonymous Japanese fellow is on in a payphone and he shoots him in the face four times and actually says aloud, "For Betty Davis."
Yeah.
and we know.
Because she has made, I don't know if we want to make this clear, she has just made an offhand comment. She's really angry
about
the
whole
thing.
Yes.
Kill a Jap for
yeah,
me.
But we know, she's so moved by the war.
We know that she doesn't mean that, don't we?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's like, okay, I'm on a mission. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's kind of a sign. I mean, you know, of course, you know, these books. Well, when we were talking before about the kind of like moral ambiguity and the fact mm-hmm. that these are historical novels, mm-hmm. but everything, you know, like everyone's morals are murky and, you know, any kind of moral code almost always seems to be a matter of convenience or delusion or aesthetics.
Absolutely.
And that's what makes his view of history so L.A. You know, that's what makes Los Angeles like the perfect breeding ground for his fictions, mm-hmm. wherever they lead to, because, you know, that...
Because of Hollywood, because of what's real, what's not.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
And
the fact that everything is driven by a kind of commerce, whether it's actually reflected
absolutely.
In money or not.
And you could look at all the characters. Dudley is a Catholic who saw terrible things in Ireland and left Ireland. He hates the British and therefore has no problem with the Germans.
Right.
He's not behind yeah. the wall, and yet he's signing up.
Right, right, right. Well, it's
I think we heard a couple times that the Irish lit bonfires to lead yeah. the British
yeah.
bombers to London.
Right, right, right.
The German bombers.
And to me,
what did I say? British bombers?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's not what I meant.
No, but still.
Yeah.
But you know, and I got the feeling when it would come up that "You Can't Go Home Again" thing. If he goes to Ireland, he has to adopt an ideology again.
You maybe. Know? Oh, right. Yeah.
So there's almost yeah. returning to a point in his life where...
Well, he's evolved beyond that, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He's the commercial. He's into and commerce. He's into his own self.
Survival
because
arts,
the other
yeah.
prominent Catholic in the book is his biggest enemy. They're fighting each other.
Right. Yes. Whiskey Bill.
It's not... Yeah. yeah. They're beyond the things that they seem to...
What did
think
you think
important.
of the detente that they forged with the Archbishop in this study? Like,
it was fantastic.
And off the books pact, and this religious right. thing is what's going to
they shake hands, and you believe
supersede
you
everything.
Believe right. that they will follow this,
and
pact.
It does, and yeah, they yeah. do.
They
right.
do.
I mean, there's one little tiny.
Well, Bill has a couple
exception.
Of moments where he thinks, "Oh, I'm going around the pact here, but
right,
I'm not breaking it."
The
right,
spirit
right,
of
right.
the pact is intact,
well, and that's in the view of religion that these characters have that yeah. they both, in their way, consider themselves to be good Catholics
yeah.
because they believe in a God who is calling them to greatness.
Yeah, one mm-hmm. or the other one notices when the other one isn't in church.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, he wasn't here this Sunday. I collect and disapprove. Right. Like, hilarious. And then Kay Lake makes it in there, too. She
right.
sits in two rows behind and notices them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Claire embraces Catholicism.
Uh-huh.
It seems to be a completely aesthetic choice
right. for Joan of Arc
because it's
a haircut.
It's yeah. it's more glamorous than the.
But she's such an actress, and this is, I think, why she admires Kay so much because
Kay's
you know,
a good actress.
Kay is yeah. a great actress because she has no convictions and because she will throw
right.
herself.
And,
oh,
yeah.
I'll be this.
I'll be this, and in the hope that I might find the thing by right. acting it.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I might.
Yeah.
I might.
Right.
This might work for me.
Right. It's like what I know is that I like to be admired. I like to have sex with brutal men. And everything else is kind of murky to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And being an informant for the police doesn't especially appeal to her. Being a communist doesn't especially appeal to her. But she tries them both on,
right? Yeah, absolutely.
And finds exciting things in both.
Well, that's the thing. I felt like all those things appeal to her.
Could this be the thing?
Yes.
And she doesn't try them on casually.
It's the adventure.
Yes.
She's a method actor.
She has to commit.
When she goes to pull out the you want to help me pull the wiretaps, and she's like, okay.
Yeah.
And you see her in her cashmere sweater and heels, you know, pulling, getting all grimy and dusty, going behind the walls of the police department in City Hall.
Well, and when Betty Davis has ultimately spurned Dudley and he has run into the arms of all people.
You've inconvenienced me.
But he runs into the arms of Claire DeHaven. I did not see that coming. And it just gets more and more beautiful as it goes. But
it's so sweet.
It really is. And she's describing, you know, kind of her intellectual makeup, and she has read Stanislavski, and she's pretty sure Kay Lake has as well.
Exactly, because she sees the evidence. Whether Kay Lake has or has not, she embodies that technique, which is cool.
Right.
And the idea at the beginning of the book that Dudley and Claire DeHaven end up together, it seems repulsive somehow.
Right.
And yet, at that point, it does seem sweet.
Yeah.
How does he do that?
Uh-huh.
How does he drag us into that place where that seems inevitable and needed?
And well, that's the happy. Yeah. This is a happy. This book ends happy.
It really does.
In defiance of all logic.
No, it does.
Because you've left your logic behind. Because you're, the logic which suggests that we have to stop bad things and we need good things gets left behind, and it's all relative.
Yeah, it's person's relationships with persons.
The really horrendous things that are suggested, which include horrendous eugenic.
Oh my God, the surgery stuff.
We just say glimpses of. It's beautiful. It's weird. It's ugly. It brings everything together. It brings race and Hollywood and violence together.
I mean, I feel like this book is like romantic and psychotic in equal measure.
Yeah.
Like one is constantly snaking ahead of the other a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think and it comes. You know, I think it's like a side effect of his process. He's immersed in this period, but someone else does all his research.
Mm-hmm.
So he has all these timelines in front of him, and he is just blasting Beethoven and riffing. He knows these characters, and he's riffing on the themes of these times. So this eugenic scheme to protect the Japanese people by giving them plastic surgery to turn them Chinese
is just... It's so preposterous.
Even though most characters say the white people can't tell the difference anyway.
Yes, and even experts are saying there's really not a...
Chinese people are being killed in L.A. because people think they're Japanese.
Right. And Hideo is saying we are of the same race. We are ideologically different.
We're different nations. Right.
Insane.
Well, but also that it doesn't work. If you're Japanese, you can tell could tell if someone's been surgically altered to look Chinese. And they don't look Chinese.
Right.
Whatever. There's all these different layers to it.
Yeah.
It's such a crackpot, crazy scheme.
That it just might work.
It just might work.
Yeah, some very serious people.
Right to the top of the FBI.
Right, yes, yes.
Right? Well, Herb Hoover is introduced. An early Hoover.
Oh, Hoover.
So funny.
And I don't
Fantastic.
Have you read his Hoover in the Underworld USA trilogy?
I can't wait to. I am so... excited to read the rest of all of these. I read The Black Dahlia. Okay, can I just say, I said this has a happy ending, right?
Yes.
It's very romantic, blah, blah, blah. Can I just say how devastated I was with the introduction of Elizabeth Short.
Oh, yes.
Who becomes, of course, the Black Dahlia, brutally murdered on self-murder. Right,
and
the Black Dahlia.
Who's a real person. You know, but Elroy chooses to make her Dudley Smith's
favorite illegitimate daughter.
Initially, the most soap opera contrivance.
Right.
But somehow works.
Yeah.
It just does. And she is everything you want her to be. She's sweet.
Right.
She is smart. She's beautiful. Everybody, who is that beautiful girl?
Yeah.
She's innocent.
Right, right,
she
right.
helps this blind man by explaining everything.
And she is Dudley's favorite.
She is
favorite. And Betty Davis realizes why. And it's because she's illegitimate, it acknowledges the part of him that's illegitimate. And she can't look at him as... as a disappointment, as morally dubious, like his own children might if they knew what he did.
Right.
And for that reason, she's the favorite.
Yeah.
And she also, I feel like, you know, I mean, what we see of Bucky Bleachert and Lee Blanchard, I mean, clearly, you know, I mean, Lee is a very troubled guy and his relationship with Kay is very complicated. Mm-hmm. And Bucky, we mainly see through Hideo's eyes or through Kay's ogling, desperate, lustful eyes.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, sort of an innocent figure despite, you know, his dubious decisions and betrayals. But like this, that girl is looming in his future. Her as a corpse is going to destroy this,
Bucky.
You know, Bucky, you know, this all-American.
Bucky. But it seems like even when we glimpse Bucky through Dudley or through Parker, which is not very much, they seem to see him as this tall, handsome man and with this goofy smile that somehow makes him even more attractive. And you can see they look at him as this perfect recruit, and it's like he's ripe for the kind of things that are going to happen,
the downfall, the heartbreak, the all of it,
right.
And you almost see in Scotty some of the Bucky stuff as well.
Yeah, okay, Scotty is kind of the Bucky Monkey in this one.
He is, and you can see him setting up Kay to, I mean, even though she's already obsessed with Bucky, her relationship with him is setting
his heart is broken.
Yes.
He enlists and he's like, I can't do this. This is so fucked up.
Well, and that's what, I mean, he's...
And why doesn't that happen more?
I know.
Well, that's the point. There's a point where that it was surprising Scotty is leaving this world, but then that reminds me of how deep into it I am.
Exactly, right. Because this is not a real
world. I've been dragged to this morally ambiguous level.
Another thing that James Ellery was saying when he was speaking was how what a fantastic, fun, rollicking trip it is to be able to immerse yourself in this world, to be able to sleep with Bette Davis, to be able to murder all these people, to be able to, and nobody gets hurt. He said, and you can see he believes it. He's really, this guy is super captivating in person.
Yeah.
He said, he was describing this as his most open-hearted work to date. And someone was asking him, what's made you so open-hearted?
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about, well, he quit drinking.
Uh-huh.
He was talking about, prayer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meditation.
Right.
A desire to write, more profoundly.
Yeah.
And he said he took a critical look at his over to date, and that's where it led him.
Right.
And it is. This book is, I say human over and over again with all that entails. He really gets it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can feel him evenly distributed through the characters.
Absolutely.
All these characters are him.
It wouldn't work if you couldn't somehow empathize with all of them.
Right, yeah. Well, because there's a hustler showman in him that is Dudley Smith. There's the recovering alcoholic, you know, wrestling with that every day.
That is Whiskey Bill.
Whiskey Bill.
Mm-hmm. Boy, didn't that ring true? He's like the thirst.
Oh,
okay,
right.
It's been 5 days.
Yeah.
Okay, if I can make it to Sunday.
Right.
And that's what's great. The first part of the book, especially, the time is really compressed.
Right.
And this is where the accumulation of the sleepless days, you can really feel it impacting on the characters.
Yeah.
And you can feel their psychosis just coming on.
Right,
you can see...
He coughed and popped 3 bennies.
Oh,
yeah. He popped 3 bennies.
Dudley Smith is not sleeping. He's on...
Or drunk or shuddering
from
lack of
drink.
And
the only time anyone sleeps are in the cots
at the police station. You can tell because they got the white pills on.
And they're doing, and he's doing intense criminological, like reverie research. Yeah, in his little spells.
Right.
And
when he goes off into his fugue state
And what are we talking about, Dudley?
Yes.
And the opium den, which seems to just throw it out into this the timeless zone.
Right.
You wonder why what happens in to him at the end doesn't happen before. You know, somebody comes and attacks him when he's vulnerable like that.
Well, because he's been through this whole thing, I feel like, you know, even though he's in this vulnerable state, he's still Dudley Smith, but he's got, by that point in the book, that, like, the concept...
He's got something on everybody. At that point, the only person who's going to try anything on his life is someone who is just erratic and not making a power play, but someone who was just emotional. And that's why it has to be Kay.
I mean, as much, you know, like immersed in the headspaces, I mean, the use of the third person intimate voice, like the fact that
it's
you're
just
in
like
their
this,
heads.
We get like cinematic flashes of them, though. We, you know, like it'll italicize and go into interior monologue.
It's brilliantly done.
It really
because
is.
It doesn't explain itself. It doesn't say... you can read a whole paragraph of a chapter.
And who am I with right now?
But you know because of the language that's used.
Yeah.
Because
who they refer to?
It's Hideo because he walked down the street, jap.
Right, behind him.
Right.
Or even in what it suggests about the mental language, like which particular racial invective they're using.
Absolutely.
The K. Lake diaries. Just cast all those parts into such higher relief, and it shocks me that he went there. I feel like it's Elroy in drag, and we're like seeing.
He's definitely got
a
window into the female sensibility.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, and you know, but she's an obsessed, driven, irrational. You know, she's the demon dog of Hollywood romance in her way. She's like, you know,
and you can't help but love her.
Yeah.
Oh. The same as in the Black Dahlia, you can't help but sympathize with her and love her.
Right.
Absolutely.
For all of her,
And she's like all these men. I mean, like Elizabeth Short, you know, as we come to know her, you know, like forensically in the Black Dahlia, is this ultimate, you know, victim. And it's sad to see her, before that point. Here.
Well, before that point, but you see her the minute she meets Betty Davis. Betty Davis says, oh, she's going to go home and imitate my hairstyle
that
tonight.
That scene is fantastic.
And she is going to spend the next months adapting my mannerisms and becoming me. And it's just like, you know, that's going to happen.
Also,
and it's so sad.
But also, Betty Davis is watching her.
Yeah.
Because she's thinking about... Yeah. She's thinking about her next role. She's thinking about...
Uh-huh, right.
I'm thinking about, where did Betty Davis go after this? Was it now Voyager? Is Elizabeth Short the kind of the mousy version? Is she the more... I don't know.
Right, that's
a great question. I want to go look at the dates of this now.
And she's seeing... And Betty Davis has so much self that there's no room for anyone else.
No.
Right. And she's seeing someone with no self.
Absolutely.
You know,
and she can project onto
herself.
That so beautifully.
Yeah.
The understanding of her character, because in a way it's a caricature of Betty Davis based on an idea that we all might have of her.
Right.
But within that, there's some real sympathy for that arrogance.
Yeah.
That the arrogance of that film star who needs everybody to look at them.
The minute they go into the restaurant, she's up getting donations for the
boys. She's also doing good. She's doing good things.
Yeah.
And, it's.
Well, and there's something, you know, like in the previous L.A. books, of course, in that world, in that time, you know, these cop worlds and these crime worlds and the movie worlds are going to overlap, and it's this industry city. And, I feel like in his previous books, like these glimpses of the Hollywood world, it's always like these, you know, like desperate, driven, you know, cops or criminals who are kind of operating in the shadow of that world. So we meet movie stars here and there.
Right.
But we don't get this.
We don't really get into that world. We don't see, like, they're these godlike figures.
I wonder if it's because the movies that have been made of his things, now he has more experience with that.
Perhaps,
And so he can more readily adopt that persona.
Right.
In a realistic way.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, but I love. I mean, we're already setting up the prostitutes who look like movie stars.
Oh my god, we're gonna cut them to look like movie stars, and it's just like, oh Jesus, it's gonna happen.
Right.
Oh, it's gonna happen.
So you know, so that like these you know, examinations of all these demented things happening in the shadow of this, you know, this religious construct that is show business. But,
I did want to say something. So when Mark and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, how the main mystery of this book, who murdered these people?
Yes.
And why did it happen? Yeah. And everything around that it the whole book's conceit is that we're pursuing this, and everyone's obsessed with it in a different way. Right. For or not, you know, they don't want to know.
Yeah.
Is it Whiskey Bill who wants to rescue the koi? That's his like biggest motivation. in Larkin's house.
That's like a drunk.
It's so cute. It's adorbs. We're putting in the pond. Yeah. So, but
they all survive
by the end. Yeah. I know.
The koi survive. That spoiler.
Aren't we happy?
Okay. No.
As if. Right. When the truth finally comes to light, you don't care anymore. It is so not actually what the book is about.
Right.
And one of the things Elroy said was he characterized this and all of his books as revealing the secret human infrastructure of large public events.
Yeah.
So the murder of the Watanabes is just his entree.
Right.
And it's the human infrastructure, the secret human infrastructure that he's interested in revealing. And it only came to me quite late that the murder is a MacGuffin. It's just not actually, the glass and the shrimp and the off ramps and the farms and the whatever. It's interesting, interesting,
absolutely.
Very intriguing. Absolutely. When Hideo goes, something's missing, scabbards. It's like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And yet, not what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like that, you know, detective faculty is just an aspect of this fascinating character.
Right.
That's the line of work that these people are in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's going to, but I mean, in a way, like Pearl Harbor is a MacGuffin.
I know.
To get us into this time and these characters. And these are historical novels, but I feel like, I mean, his voice is so strong. Elroy's voice is so ferocious and so strong. I always feel like he's just Coltraning this stuff. It's just him riffing on these events.
Absolutely.
You know, and so it's, you know,
it's not the event, it's the humans.
Yeah.
And it's
and the idea, I mean, everything's, you know, our culture is so fragmented and like endlessly fractalizing now and constantly commenting on itself and deconstructing itself.
Yeah.
It's almost like you have to look, you know, like far enough into the past where you could have an historical event that sweeps through everyone's unconscious. Everyone's going to have their own like damage and their own reaction to this historical event.
Right.
But the idea of all of us laboring in the shadow of one thing that just happened.
Brilliant thing is that the way that we learn history growing up and the way we think about history growing up is, and I mean, I didn't grow up in America, but the impact of Pearl Harbor on the Americans, it very much isn't the impact that it has on all these characters in the book. Uh-huh. They're all thinking about so many different things.
Which is how it works. I mean, you describe this as a historical novel. I would never do that, but it's totally true.
Uh-huh.
You know, for me, it's crime drama. It's
But
it really does. It gets, and that's what great historical fiction does.
But it's
not
beyond
the history that's the thing.
It's truer. It's true. It gets to the point where, I mean, I think with certain writers of historical fiction, you want to ask them a question: how much research do you do? What's true? What's not?
Right.
With Elroy, it gets beyond that. It's somewhere else.
Well, it's like the dream life of history. It's
completely,
like,
and it's all of those rumors, especially with the Hollywood stuff.
Yeah,
all the rumors and dreams that you have, like the Clark Gable playing.
With Salvador Dali's Leopard.
Yeah,
and
that just seems so true. that is Clark Gable,
right?
And it doesn't even matter.
Yeah.
At what point?
Yeah.
Someone that he would never been.
Which is why it doesn't matter.
It steps way beyond that.
Well, to look at a historical moment through the eyes, like all the characters are in their own way irrational, obsessed, driven. They're unmoored from consensus reality in some way because of some very private thing that's driving them.
Right.
So you don't get this third person objective view of
Hideo needs to avenge these people, kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of not.
He needs to see Bucky bleach it naked.
Absolutely. You know,
like, that's actually
that's his soul, you know.
Even the at the beginning, Whiskey Bill has this analysis of the war, and he seems like he's way ahead.
Right.
When he says, it's not about the war. It's about what happens afterwards. It's about the Reds against us.
Afterwards,
right.
These farms.
But we realize that even that is not the point. Even that is he's not way ahead of anybody there with that. Even though, from our perspective, that's a really perceptive read on the war. That he's not running around panicking that the Japanese might bomb LA, but that he's way ahead. But
because it's all going to happen, and it's going to. They were all. What I liked was how they were. They all had this perspective that war is coming. War is coming to the U.S. War is, the Japs are. They're amassing in the Philippines. The Philippines is where they're going to go. Uh-huh. Everyone had this idea already, which is kind of not. I mean, we weren't around when Pearl Harbor, Harbor was bombed. So, it's that kind of perspective is totally interesting to me.
Yeah,
and irrelevant.
Right.
And you know, I love the. The excitement generated by the war. I think that's
all
really,
the bunting that comes up, all the new storefronts,
the,
all that.
The people enlisting, the parties. it's not people walking around morosely. So this is a terrible thing.
Right. No.
War doesn't happen like that.
It's like, you know.
Well, it didn't used to happen like that.
I had an experience that I'm surprised I didn't remember this in relation to this book in the process of reading it. But my Pearl Harbor experience, and this is not an astral projection past life story.
You were a twinkle in your
Twinkle. Not even. I was like a follicle of something in his testes. I was in a movie theater. I don't know what I was seeing. It was in the 90s, and a trailer came on for Pearl Harbor, the movie. Mm-hmm. And I eventually saw some of this movie, and, you know, it's rubbish. But the trailer, I don't know what mood I was in that moment, but it swept me away, and I felt this great lachrymose, like, sorrow and sense of being bereft that my generation didn't have a thing.
That's a thing.
Like a purpose that drew everyone together and that made like every life part of a master narrative. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as it was over, I wanted to take a shower because I felt like I'd been profoundly manipulated.
Into patriotic frenzy.
Yeah. Right. And then 9/11 happened like a year later. And looking back, you know, again, not to, God forbid we should go into a conspiracy theory when discussing Perfidia, but I just look back on all the World War II films that were coming out in the 90s. And how they were kind of like reframing the war experience, like on a social programming level, because up till that point, what war was Vietnam?
The Second World War has always been an easier sell in the West
because there's a perceived it feels moral.
It's morally very black and white,
you can say we were the good guys and we won.
Right.
And you can sweep all the morally ambiguous stuff under the carpet,
The
which you can't do subsequently.
Nobody talked about the rape of Nanking.
Right.
Nobody, you know, now, even 9/11, people say, well, you know, Western excess, religious fanaticism. Religious fanaticism across the globe.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
We've got it, too. And so it's... Nothing is ever going to be that black
Elroy,
and white.
Elroy knows that frequently that kind of fanaticism is a facade for opportunism.
Yeah,
and for money makers and power grabbers,
and that
feels perceptive to me.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yeah, and I feel like part of his project, you know, because we get J. Edgar Hoover, we get you know, young, sleazy Jack Kennedy, you know,
brilliant.
And Joe, too.
Right, yes.
I mean, and what's great about Joe Kennedy has anyone ever said a good word about Joe Kennedy?
I know.
No. And even Elroy can't make him...
I don't think he did anything to deserve a good word.
But
he was a great power broker,
I love Jack. You know, he's just so.
If only he had gotten a hold of Hitler earlier, we could have been on the side of the Germans in that war.
Right. Indeed. I like that these historical personages kind of like slew us through this thing.
Yeah.
And so we're getting these great moments in history, but it's from the point of view of the people who had to break the legs.
That's the human infrastructure. And that's why we care.
Yeah.
Yeah. None of these people, despite even the real characters who actually had William Parker couldn't be Jack Kennedy.
Right.
For all of his, successful career.
Right.
he couldn't be Jack Kennedy. Right, yeah. Jack Kennedy just kind of stumbled into being Jack Kennedy, and you see glimpses of his conscience emerging in between his various
and sexual the weird encounters thing with Gloria Swanson. And
I had to fuck her out back by the pool.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
And,
love
that. And
got
and,
a sunburn.
Yes, and yes, and I guess notoriously not well hung. And
hung like a cashew.
Hung like a cashew. Yes,
was the.
I love how all these scurrilous rumors come
they
in.
They cohere. Yes, yes. You're going to get the sleaziest version of, because this is this guy's dream life, and when he contemplates these figures. But in American tabloid, they all the women that he's with, Kennedy, they call him Bad Back Jack.
Mm.
Because he
has a bad back.
Well, because he's a premature ejaculator, and he would always blame it on I'm all done. And,
had I didn't
on his
know
bad
that
back.
Was the rumor or truth.
Yeah, right, that's what they say.
Yeah.
But anyway, well, I think we've all loved this book to pieces. I think is there anything else you want to address that we haven't?
I want Mark to tell the joke that he opened his talk at Powell's with last weekend.
Oh, yes. Okay. James Elroy at Powell's.
He came onto the stage. He didn't introduce himself. He didn't say anything. Applause just died down. And he just said, and I'm not going to try an accent.
Oh, do it. It was so great when you did it before.
He just said, a lion is fucking a zebra. The zebra looks back.
From behind.
Oh.
It makes it really funny.
Okay.
A lion is fucking a zebra from behind. The zebra turns around and says, here comes my husband. Pretend you're trying to kill me. A lion.
Do it again. Do the voice because it's funny.
A lion. A lion.
Is fucking a zebra.
People listen. Yeah. A lion. It's fucking a zebra.
Another zebra.
A lion.
Yeah.
From behind.
The zebra sees her husband. And so she
sees another zebra approaching.
Her husband. And she's like, please stay. Just pretend you're killing me because it's my husband. It's really good. It's a good joke. And
and well told.
Especially in Portland, Oregon, because it was a nice way to turn up and say, I might say words that you might not like to hear, even though you really like to hear them.
Right.
And James Elroy.
I'm James Elroy, and I'm from Los Angeles.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, my God. He said about L.A. Someone was asking about, why L.A.? It seems to be the perfect setting for all this. And he goes, I grew up there. Yeah. I'm L.A. from way back.
L.A.
is where I go when my wives divorce me.
Yeah.
I live there now.
Or I sit in the dark and I brood about women. That's it. From the Hilliker curse. Yes.
Aw.
Yes. So.
A lion.
A lion. Sorry, go ahead. You want to give it another whirl?
No.
Okay. No. Okay, so we want everyone to read this book, right?
Oh yeah,
yeah. And then read all this book.
Here's the thing: it's super long. You get about a third in it, you're like, I'm never going to finish this book because it doesn't. I don't know. You don't want to be precious about every word you're reading. There's too much. That's what's kind of cool about it.
Yeah.
But it's also just kind of like, it starts to feel like this slog, but then things speed up.
Yeah.
And I couldn't put it down the last half of the book.
Right.
And so. Persevere.
Yes, and I always find with him, and a lot of people that I really like, but him especially, when I'm in a morass of names and plot convolutions, I start reading it aloud, and I feel he's one of the most musical writers.
Interesting. I really saw that.
Yeah, I feel like this.
I really notice it with this book more than other books of his that there was a beauty in that sentence structure.
Yeah.
When we talk about great imagery,
yeah,
he does it, but he almost does it backwards by trying. You know, he's not trying to give you poetry, and yet he's giving you poetry. Yeah. He's just giving you,
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's someone who's has made it his life's work to sit in the dark and dream hard. Mm-hmm. And he's like, his prose, it's like photographs.
Yeah.
It's like, it's photograph, it's collage. It's what Dudley Smith has.
Absolutely. It's collage. That's a good word.
He gets up really early. He goes to bed at 8 o'clock, gets up at, he said 2:33 in the morning because he wants to get the drop on the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Ah, yeah.
That's so great. Right? It's like he's lying.
It's like he's
in
sneaking up behind us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a lion.
Right? Uh-huh. Coming, fucking us from behind.
It was such a good try, honey.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was really, actually, it was a terrible try. But I appreciate that.
I'm going to cut all the pieces together and
leave it like
that.
Perfect. It sounds great. All right. I'm happy with that.
Okay, right on.
I am too. Ecstatic.
great. Okay, it has been our great pleasure to examine the work of Mr. Elroy, and his new novel is Perfidia, and it gets a glowing 7-star endorsement from Book Circle Online, and
out of how many?
Out of 2. 7 stars out of 2. Get out there and read it, and read all of his books. And it's a perfect place to start, actually.
Right,
even though
it's the
this
beginning.
Is like his 19th book, but chronologically, it's
and
the
his
first.
Style is excellent. He's honed it, so you're actually better off.
Right, indeed. So, and I'm interested to actually to read The Black Dahlia.
Me too.
Again, after
and
this, because
it's stylistically, it's so different.
Yeah, and it's so like going stepping into like the romantic swoon.
It's so full of a backstory.
Yeah. And I think more it would be like the Kay Lake parts, you know, bleeding into a whole book.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Like
yeah.
Because that's more of the style.
Yeah. Right? What I remember from the Black Dahlia is you get Bucky, you get his dad, you get the whole
thing of his
childhood, his school, his early boxing career,
and him mentioning turning in his friend Hideo.
He mentions that in Black Dahlia?
There's one sentence.
Oh,
this character grew.
I can't wait to reread it.
Out of one.
One of
sentence.
My favorite moments in this book is when Bucky is being sat down, and you thinking, is he going to sell out his friend? And he just does it like that
immediately.
Right?
Immediately, without even hesitating.
He's another
opportunist. I love that moment.
Yeah. No, it's beautiful. And then, you know, because he hasn't had his great obsession is not called out to him yet.
No, and it seems like he's naively doing it. Maybe I don't know.
And he's Hideo's greatest obsession. I mean, it's just
right. Obsession. His great theme, obsession.
They really want to find meaning. They're really, really thinking.
Right. Yeah. You know, and yes, history is a side effect of millions of people doing things that they just can't help doing.
Their own stuff.
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily happen to people as much as people happen to it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right. Lovely. We could go on for days.
Seriously, this is really fun, you guys.
This has been Book Circle Online. I have been and will continue to be, for the most part, Jason Squamata. I am here with...
To the best of my knowledge, I will continue to be Pat Janowski.
And?
A lion. Mark Savage.
A lion indeed. And you can find us on iTunes. If you want, you can leave some comments.
You can pick us up on a shortwave radio that you hide in an attic above your
If you
rooms.
Did, and we'll give you news of the coming invasion.
And President Rosenfeld.
Yes, and President Franklin Double-Cross Rosenfeld will not stand in the way of Book Circles Online.
I have something to plug.
Yes. Oh, yes! Fantastic!
I finally have something to plug.
Pat Janowski has something to plug.
Yes, my band, Bergeret.
Ah.
We have a record that's just come out on Voodoo Donut Recordings.
How does someone
new
get
new label?
How does someone get it?
You go to Voodoo Donut Recordings.
.com
on the interwebs.
Okay. Yes.
And we are the Scuzz Rock split because we're singing fabulous French songs in about sex and drinking.
Yes.
With the word donut inserted into them.
Oh.
Interspersed with these really hard punk garage scuzzy man bands.
Nice.
So it's nice.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. Yeah. All right. So yes, everyone, go. Okay. So what's this?
It's a record.
And what's the record called?
It's called the Scuzz Rock Special.
The Scuzz Rock Special on Voodoo Donuts.
Voodoo Donut Recordings. Yeah.
Voodoo Donut Recordings. Featuring Bergeret.
Yeah.
If you want to make friends with us, you can find us on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Right?
All I ask is you send me a little message.
Send Pat a little message.
Because I'm getting requests all the time. I don't know these people.
Okay, dirty men.
So
just
say, hey,
to, right?
hey, I heard you on Book Circle Online.
Uh-huh.
Friend me.
Yeah.
I certainly will.
Brenda, we all. Okay. In the meantime.
That's how I met you.
Right? And look. And now.
Get in line.
One of the great love stories of our time.
It's revealed.
For real. It's been a pleasure having you here. Read Perfidia. Read all of James Ellroy's books. Read more books in general. We all should. We all will. Keep it bookish. Keep it circular. Keep reading alive. This has been Book Circle Online.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO, join the circle.